the conversation and turning over to John. Welcome.
Thanks, Gene. And I'm John Mayer, the executive director of CALI. I was really struggling. The hardest decision I had to make about this talk was whether or not I should wear a tie. Because I didn't know whether the room was going to be filled with faculty who I wanted to signal that I could too look presentable and wear a tie, or whether it was going to be filled with technologists and I should wear... And, you know, whether I should dress more with, I have a Creative Commons t-shirt, or I have other things that would signal to you my geek cred or something like that. Of course, in all those situations, you go to a higher power. My mother, who is deceased, I said, what would she do? She's like, Harvard, my God, wear a tie, John. Slap me upside the head. So here I am in a tie, but I do want you to know that I have geek cred. Yeah, thanks, Mom, right? Mom always knows best. Right? So I'm going to show you a whole bunch of projects, some that are old and extant, still going, which is to say, some that are very nascent and we're working on. But I also wanted to try to get a bigger picture of this, which is often hard to do. And so that's where the title of this comes, Subclassing the Commons. How many of you immediately understood that was a play on object-oriented programming, right? Two, okay, I'm not going to dig too deep into that, but I'll show you some things, right? Because what I really should have said was subclassing and instantiating the commons, all right. Gene took care of some of the preliminaries for me. Incorporated in 82 by Harvard and University of Minnesota, we are a 501c3. 25 years in June, actually earlier than that. CALI was doing the people who were behind CALI, Don Troutman, Charlie, and I don't even remember the very early folks, because I wasn't in legal education at the time. We're working in the mid-70s based off of SRI, Stanford Research Institute, programmed learning books. Those were those books where you would read a question and it would say, if the answer is A, go to page 4. If the answer is B, go to page 5. If the answer is C, go to page 6. They had branching built into the book. It was a physical book that did that. Some of you may have heard of the Plato system. I think I saw it at the University of Illinois back in the late 70s. But there was some same ideas there, that CALI could bring the same ideas of programmed learning to legal education. All right. Our membership is at 204. I bet you didn't know there were 204 law schools. That includes a wallet I found on the street that had $4,000 in it. It became a member because I was at work at the time. And things like that. But we have a growing number of affiliate programs, international law schools, paralegals, law firms, and things like that, because our material is interesting to lawyers or anybody interested in the law. And we give our stuff away free to legal aid attorneys and library schools. Obviously, we're hoping those legal aid attorneys will say positive things and to their law firm colleagues. And library schools are what produce law librarians, and it just so happens that the majority of the people that sign checks at law schools for CALI are law librarians. All right, so it's both largesse on our part and smart marketing, right? By far, we are best known for our lessons, our tutorials, which are all online. There's over 600 of them right now in 30 different subject areas. And this year was a big bump. We had a 50% increase in the fall semester, in the calendar year to year, in usage. Let me parse that out a little bit. This is a graph of lesson runs per day for three successive fall semesters. And so the yellow line, which is the most recent one, you can see big spikes there. About half the usage happening right up until about December 7th, and about half the usage happening during finals, right? Everybody studies at the last minute. How many law students are in this room? One. All right. The rest are studying. That's right. The rest are studying, right. I like to point things like this out. At the peak time, I guess, in the country when everybody was studying for finals, there was a lesson being run every 3 seconds off of our website.
You're going to show us a lesson?
Sure am. We had over 500,000 lesson runs, and we're basically on a curve for 1 million in this school year, which is cool. A million lesson learns. Now, that's not Google or Yahoo, but within our subclass of students, 140,000 law students, 200 law schools, we're doing pretty good, or at least we're pretty happy about it. This is daily website registrations, and you can see peaks at the beginning of the semester during orientation, and then peaks at the end of the semester when people realize I can get at this resource. 500 registrations on one day on December 4th, averaging 175 a day. The point of this is we're now at over 100,000 law students registered at our website. All right, so this isn't just, you know, a commercial. This is that we know we have reach and attention of this community. And when you attempt to do interesting things with the commons, you run into the, how do I get past the noise of all the other things they can see? Well, because of our presence there with our usage of lessons, we hope that we can leverage that into other valuable services that faculty, students, and institutions can use. All right, so subclassing the commons. I love this slide. Here's everything. And when you tell people about going out into the internet and get cool stuff and do things, they say, well, you know, I see something I want there, but I don't know if I'm allowed to use it or not, or whose it is or something. This is assuming you don't want to just steal it, all right? And what the commons did, or what Creative Commons did, and what you so vociferously promote, is the idea that there's this subset. By the way, this is not drawn to scale. There's this subset of everything. There's a subset of everything that is a Creative Commons, and hopefully inside that is something that I want, and I can use it, because there's signals in the fact that it's a Creative Commons. There's things that say, because it's Creative Commons, you are allowed to use it. Now, I know there's, you know, non-commercial attribution and small little changes to that, but for the most part, you're allowed to use it. And so that's a positive thing. It's right because it solved a big problem. There's all this stuff. Can I use it? I don't know. Go find out. Big hassle. Now there's a lot of this stuff. Can I use it? Yes. So it gets you past the first most difficult bump in a large global sharing community of people, right? Well, there's other problems, or there's other values there, right? So if the Creative Commons gets you that data, that's something I want. It has this built-in license. It shorthands it to say, look, I don't have to learn copyright law. I don't have to read EULAs. It just works the way I want it. And maybe there's some findability here, right? Because what tends to happen in a commons is people tend to aggregate the commons, right? All sorts of examples like that. Wikipedia aggregates encyclopedia articles. They're all the same in the sense that they're all encyclopedia articles, right? And so there's same metadata about them. So if I want to find all the Creative Commons encyclopedia articles, a good place or a good chunk of them is going to be found in Wikipedia. Flickr is a good place to go to find a huge number of photos that are in Creative Commons. Not all photos on Flickr are Creative Commons, but you get the point. Same thing with something like the PodSafe network, right? Aggregations of content that have been designated with these signals that say, use me if you want, all right? So what about law faculty and law students, though? They're not using lots of photos and, yeah, that's a great picture, isn't it? They're not using lots of photos in their study of the law. They're not using lots of PodSafe music. Notice I didn't say they're not using, I don't know. Actually, I have read recently of more law review articles pointing to Wikipedia as a source and nobody complaining. Well, right. But the point is, and now I'm going to get into like my demonstrations of things and come back to this. The point is that the commons is as just the glob of similarly formatted things, all photos, all encyclopedia articles, isn't granular enough for these subclasses of communities that want to make use of it. And in some ways, subclassing the commons, I see that almost as a great tagline for Cali, and I assume that that overlaps with Berkman's mission as well, as that's what we do. We go make this glob of things accessible and relevant to you in things that you actually want to be doing in your particular situations, meaning in this case, learning about the law, teaching the law, practicing the law, and so on. So let me show you some things that we're working on in that area. Anyhow, that was my sort of last slide. Something that law faculty, students, schools, and lawyers could want. All right. So the first problem in finding out what people want from the commons is you have to find out what they want. And there's all sorts of signals that they'll give you if you're willing to lurk on their bulletin boards, read their blogs, listen to their discussion lists. And they come up with starter phrases like this. Does anybody have? And usually it's, you know, I'm teaching contracts for the first time. Does anybody have a contract syllabus they would be willing to share with me? Boom, you get flooded, right? I've posted a paper at SSRN, would appreciate any comments. I've seen four of those in the last week on a bunch of blogs. Very interesting way to go get commentary on your legal scholarship, right? I'm working on some project. The project might involve like banning laptops in the classroom. And I was wondering if anybody else had a policy related to that or something like that, or had a discussion, right? So I'm in a situation in my institution, and I'll bet you've been, there are people out there who have been in a similar situation in your institutions and so on. Where can I find dot, 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 all right? So these are things that when I see them, I go, what if I aggregated all the answers to that question across all institutions? Is that a commons? You know, is there some nice value there, or is there like amazing value there? And the ones that come out as amazing value to me are targets of opportunity for Cali, and I think sort of Berkman projects too in some ways. But I won't speak to that. Right. All right. So first of all, we're best known for our lessons, and let me pop over to show you a lesson. Oh, I didn't bring one up. Hold on. I have to, when you shrink your screen down, everything like disappears on you. All right, where did it go? We'll have to like actually use programs. So our lessons are not really a commons because, you know, even though we hope to get people to do commons, I mean, it's really hard to find things in your own menu system. Ah, sorry, right where it should be. Because it turns out the lessons are actually, I'll just open a recent one. Lessons are really complex artifacts, all right? And that's actually a good thing that they're complex because they're doing something complex. They're teaching students about the law. This is what the lesson looks like to the student on the right-hand side. But I'm in the authoring system, which is a free piece of software that we've written, because we wanted law professors to write their own lessons. We need them as close to the iron as possible, you might say. And here's how I'm going to show you how complicated it could look. So this is basically a flowchart or a map of a lesson, including showing the fact that, you know, you could go from a question that has an answer that goes one direction or the other. It might branch, conditionally branch or something like that. All right? This idea is what law professors do. They throw out a question, so blah, 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 blah. They know the most likely way that students are going to get that question wrong, and they're waiting for it, right? Like a trapdoor spider in some ways. On the other hand, the student might get it right, whoever they randomly pick in the room, and they'll go, oh, well, and then they'll just change the question on them. Well, what about this angle and something like that, right? Now, in the realm of all possible questions that could be asked, right, this could be an infinite tree of links, but in the reality of the classroom, this is actually quite a pruned tree. And so we go to our faculty who write our lessons, and we say, write us that pruned tree as a lesson. So it's not AI, it's like dumb AI, right? So they ask questions of the students, they get feedback. Sometimes they ask questions that they know, you know, the student's going to get wrong in a certain way, and then they lead them on paths, you know, either this way or this way, that eventually come back all the time giving them feedback. Students love our lessons. They're like, oh, I get feedback. Oh, I get answers. I get yes or no. Of course, when we wrote Cali Author, we had to come up with a type of question in which the answer was, let me think if I can show it here. No, that's the third one. Yeah. Where the question was not red or green, yes or no, but was yellow. Maybe. right? The favorite word of all law professors. It depends, or it may be, or something like that. All right? So we tried to get a comment, but it turns out it's really hard to write these things, and so we had to pay faculty to write them. Perfectly fine, all right? And so all 600 lessons, not all 600, you know, they've been built over the years and things like that. But our model for building lessons now is to get five faculty over 8 months to write five lessons each, 25 lessons, all right? And we tell them, don't write a lesson that takes any longer than 25 minutes for the student to do, because that's about the attention span of a law student today before they got to go up and go to the bathroom or get some coffee or you know, check their IM messages or something like that. All right? So our old lessons used to take 8 hours to do. It would take 8 hours to run through the whole lesson. Now our new lessons only take 25 minutes, 35 minutes, or something like that. Yeah, I do. They do. But there's sort of like a tolerance for how long you'll spend watching something. Now, the faculty always push back on us. They said, I can't explain anything in 25 minutes, or I can't, you know, this topic requires more than 25 minutes. And they say, well, break it down. I mean, you've got to be able to break it down, right? And so there might be a lesson that's like adverse, like we have 9 lessons on adverse possession because there's part 1, part 2, part 3, or there's various angles or twists on that. And that's perfectly fine, right? This software is free to faculty. We'll even let you take the lessons and make changes and update them. No takers, right? It's very complex to do that. Too much of an investment. So one of the things about subclassing the commons is you got to make it lightweight. You got to let people come in and do a little bit at a time and yet get a little bit of, wow, I contributed, or I got some value, or some value was created out of that, right? Long arcs require long attention spans and either money, bribery, or true dedication to a project. All right. Second project we're working on, something called ClassCaster. All right, ClassCaster is basically a blog network, sort of Blogger, TypePad, movable type, whatever it is. Open source software that we found that we glued to Asterisk. Techie people will know that Asterisk is a PBX. It's a phone system. What the heck are we doing gluing a phone system to a blogging system? Well, we built this with this idea that we can't get faculty to, you know, deal with technical stuff too much in the classroom. So, but we know they can make a phone call. And so with ClassCaster, you can make a phone call and essentially leave an hour-long voice message. And when you hang up, it automatically converts it to an MP3 and sticks it into a blog. Instant podcasting. Oh, man, we thought we had, you know, the coolest thing in the world. All right, two problems. One, hour-long phone calls costs 60 minutes of whatever, phone time. Two, phone voice recording is pretty crappy, you know, even with the best headsets. Three, an awful lot of classrooms are in basements where phone reception is really bad. All right, this turned out to be a disaster, right? Not ClassCaster itself, but the idea that the phone as a instant podcast maker would sell it, all right? So we came back around. We launched a project about a year and a half ago called the Legal Education Podcasting Project. We gave $1,000 to faculty. Man, I had people all over me. And a free digital recorder and said, record your own podcasts. And there's an FAQ, screencasts. All you got to do is convert it to an MP3, upload it to your blog. All right, 30 faculty did it in the first semester. We've got 60 now in our third semester. And it is a true commons, right? Because I've gone back to them and I said, you know, can we make these available to anybody? In other words, no password behind it. And they're like, yeah, sure. I don't mind that other people listen to me. Now, that made them all go, but I better make sure I take some of those off-color jokes out of my talking. But they did. And a bunch of cool second-order effects happened out of that. Number one, students started to tell us, you know, I got this crappy evidence teacher who doesn't really cover things very well, so I just listen to this other evidence teacher's podcasts. So, or, you know, I really like what he's doing in the class, but I need a second opinion sort of thing that gives me another viewpoint on that. Second, faculty said to us, you know, I listen to myself and I notice that I skip over things sometimes. because I know this stuff so well. I've been teaching it for years and years. Faculty have been teaching for 15, 20 years, told us this. And so as a result of listening to their own podcasts, they've improved their own teaching. I'm like, hallelujah, deliberative practice, right? Where you actually watch what you do and improve upon it, all right? Other faculty said, you know, I've never taught this class before. I've only taught this class once. I'm listening to this other guy who's taught this class 20 times, and I'm learning from him. I'm stealing ideas. It's like, hallelujah, sharing teaching tips and things like that, right? The students told us in a survey we did, here I can jump over to that, I think. We did surveys and, it's over here. We did surveys and, let me jump to one professor's blog here. We did surveys and I interviewed 15 or 20 faculty about podcasting and whether it suppressed attendance in the class. It did not. About whether it was, a problem with student speaking. In some classes, it was. I had a couple of faculty who were teaching family law, and they inevitably speak about things like domestic violence, rape, child custody, other issues like that. And they felt that, you know, that was not something they wanted to record for all posterity, or that it would suppress free sharing of ideas in the classroom. Perfectly fine. All right? We had faculty do podcasting one of two ways. Some of them just recorded the classroom, right? Some of them waited until the end of the week and basically, based on the feedback they got from their students, they did a 15-minute to half hour, here's the things that I want to make sure you got. And so they did like a little summary podcast. Students wrote back and with us in the survey and said, can you make the faculty do both? You know, both record the class because I can re-listen to it, and if I missed, I have blanks in my notes or something like that. And I like the summaries because I feel like those are insights into the final exam and things like that. All right? So we're going to go back to those faculty, and we're going to put them into essentially a podcast commons of law classes. The problem is we tried to give them a tool to tag them. You know, tell us what class this is, not just what class this is, what are you teaching? Right? And we have a model for doing that. Let me go to the Cali website and show you how we tag our lessons. I have to find it quickly. It's something that we call the Cali Topic Grids. Lessons by course outline. Oops. That'll get me to the same place. Here, let's do business associations. All right. One of the artifacts of the Cali lesson production is deciding what to title a lesson or what to write about in a lesson. So before any of the faculty who write lessons for us, is they create a giant list of 25-minute long topics. All right? And this is the one for biz orgs, business associations. And you can see it's kind of big. And in this case, everywhere where there's a lesson, you can't see it too well on the screen because it doesn't look like it's showing up. But those are links to actual lessons. Well, this is what? A taxonomy. And it's a taxonomy of words from the mouths of faculty. And when they wanted to get all complicated or about how to create this taxonomy, we said, well, here's how you would describe anything that you were teaching. So you get a call, your son has broken his leg playing soccer. You rush over to your colleague and you say, would you teach this class for me? I got to go. And he says, what are you teaching? And you say, one of the things that's on this taxonomic list, on this Cali topic grid. It's that elevator pitch of what a course is. All right. So we have this already for like about 10 areas. We started by looking at hundreds of syllabi in those courses, and then we handed over to the faculty and they sort of refined it and things like that. Sequence doesn't matter on this list, just that something appears, you know, sort of structure and something. And so we have to go back over our podcast lessons and re-tag them so that they can be found. All right, this is an important point. Our lessons are already tagged that way, and now we want to tag podcasts, right? So if you can find a podcast on a topic, then you can also find the lessons on that topic. If you can find the lessons on the topic, you can find the podcast on the topic, and so on and so forth. All right, next project. This is called Access to Justice. I took a sabbatical back in 2001 helping legal aid organizations consolidate all the websites in one state, in this case Illinois, into one massive website. It was also a community development project because everybody was writing their own how to expunge your criminal record, how to delay evictions and things like that. You know, there are 7 legal aid organizations in the state. They all had their own brochure. We were trying to, put this into one place, a commons of sorts, right? Well, Access to Justice, and I'll actually pull up the actual software, solves a different problem. Turns out that the forms you have to fill out in court are complicated. Who'd have thunk, right? They're especially complicated for people with English as a second language, people who are not familiar with courts, people who are stressed out because they're in a court-type situation or something like that. And so we designed an interface, and I'll hit the preview button here.
Welcome to the Ventura County Court Fee Waiver Interview. Enter your name and select your gender.
Hit stop on that. We designed an interface that basically asks one question at a time. All right. This is essentially a JavaScript form, except instead of all the things being stacked up, which you can do really easily, frankly, this just goes one at a time. All right. Further than that, by the way, all usability tested. People like, oh my gosh, I like this. It's actually pleasant to fill out this form. Kind of fun, or something like that. Right. What else do we do? Notice this is a giant map, like the one I showed you in the Cali Author. I'm gonna have to make it even smaller. And it has branches in it, and that's because a form will say, how many children do you have? And then leave you like half a page to fill that in. None. And then you skip over it, right? Well, in this case, how many children do you have? One question comes at you. You say none. It skips around all those children questions. All right? So there's all...
Welcome to the Ventura County...
Stop. I'm going to just fill in some crap here. Now, the reason why it asks you male or female is because... In all the testing, we weren't sure how to like present an avatar to people. We tried photographs. As soon as we tried photographs, we got into, well, you know, if you have a white person, you got to have a black person. You got a black person, you got to put someone in a wheelchair, you know. And then how do you know which one to show to which person? Well, should we ask them? Do you want a African American guy? Do you want a an American Indian guy? It's like, oh. So we came up with this avatar, and this avatar is not white. It is blank. All right. But we did run into the gender issue, and so we finally decided, okay, the first question of all of these interviews were, are you a man or a woman? So I'll click male here just so you can see what the other avatar looks like.
Okay.
And
if you owe court fees and
hit stop there. And that becomes you, all right? And so now this person is basically going to walk you closer and closer to that far distant thing, which is the courthouse, which is justice, or at least the filling out of this form. So you answer these questions one at a time. When you're done and press submit, it goes off to a hot doc server, Lexis sponsors. The hot doc server comes back with the filled out form, which you can then print, sign, and fill out. Right now, of course, we're working with courts for not go to the hot doc server, but go right into an electronic filing or a docketing system, right, using XML. And that's an important point because, as I said about subclassing, and I showed you that little sort of phony XML document, the text that runs this interview, it's called a guided interview, is in XML. Let's see if I can find it. Yeah, I can. No, I can't. Yeah, there it is. Okay, this is it. California. This is the California Fee Waiver. All right. So by separating the delivery of the interface from the data, we could create other interfaces or make changes to the interface, you know, without mucking about with the underlying XML. And the underlying XML can also be transformed into other things to go into other systems, like legal aid, case management systems, which is something we're working on. Now, there's a commons around this, too, right? Because this is an authoring system used by lawyers, not by techies. These are not custom programmed, right? I'll go to one question here. Actually, I'm going to look for one that's got a, And I'll just show you, I'll try to show you the advanced button. All right, it's got very sort of minimal macros built into it. So if you get the person's name, you can turn around and then say, well, thank you, first name. You know, it doesn't say thank you, first name. It says thank you, John, or something like that. It will do the him and hers. It will let you do conditional branching. You know, if their income is over $18,000 and they live in Cambridge County, then they're eligible for food stamps. And so you could do some relatively sophisticated things. All right? Now, immediately what you should be thinking is, all these forms and all these courts, they're all different, right? Yeah, about 10% different. And so what we've got is people, groups of people working in one state to do all the forms for their state, but they can immediately share these with somebody else in another state who can then go in and say, well, Idaho is slightly different than Illinois. Here's where those changes are, and only make those small changes. So they're not. So not everybody who has to do this is starting from scratch. This is a big deal with the commons, right? Don't always have to start from scratch. I can always stand on the shoulder of giants or of other people who have come before me. And so we designed this system explicitly with that capability to share interviews amongst the authors, all right? We got about 8 states working on these, a few circuit courts, and about a year ago, we got a federal district court very interested. And they came to us and said, here's what we want to do. We want to do all our forms, and then we're going to go share them with all the other federal courts. And we're like, yes, that is exactly what we were hoping would happen. All right? Whole thing's written in Flash. You know, runs on the web. And, you know, it's starting to gain some good traction there. All right. What else was I going to show you? This is a project that's like super beta, meaning it's alpha, meaning it's not even running. But I call it Scholarship Pulse. And the reason why I call it Scholarship Pulse is because scholarship is a blood sport. Right? No. All right. Faculty love to talk about their scholarship and love to be talked about with their scholarship. Right? I gave you that example of people saying, I've posted this to SSRN. So what this is on the left is a paper that's basically I yanked out of SSRN. I converted it into Flash. I didn't use Flash paper. Somebody was talking about Flash paper. But I might be using Flash paper. And on the right is basically a comment system where you can, where you would go and then type comments. Now these aren't, this isn't real because it's a totally beta system. But the idea behind this is then we would start with a group of faculty, like maybe all the ALS section chairs, and we'd say, you are the charter peers, and you get to decide whether other people are peers. A peer is, I've written a paper, I'm a tax professor, I've written a paper on tax. I want to know what other tax professors have to say, right? More than I want to know what other law professors say who aren't tax professors, more than I want to know what law students have to say, more than I want to know what anonymous commenters might say, right? And so we're experimenting with signals like that. So there's 2 experiments here that you can sort of barely see, but these are the comments. There's like 7 comments on this paper. Notice green represents peers, yellow represents law professors, gray is law students, right? And you can filter by those things. So I can click on that and the law student comments go away. I don't want to see any law student comments, right? Or I only want to see, you know, my peers or something like that, right? The other thing we're doing is experimenting with the idea that maybe the font should be larger for how prominent you are in the system. This is actually turned on its head. Law students are larger here. It should be the other way around. You know how caps are shouting? Well, then maybe larger font is, you should hear me more clearly, or something like that. All right? Now, we know we're playing in something that I call ego space here, right? But we think that that's actually, if we do this right, if we get the social engineering right, it will actually be of tremendous benefit to faculty, because there's a lot of controversy over the idea that counting downloads on SSRN is a proxy for quality of scholarship. Right? I don't agree. That's crazy, right? And there's all sorts of ways you can game that, and there's counter moves to ungame that, and that's an arms race. I think what's interesting is what people say and who they are about your scholarship. That's the pulse, right? You're dead unless people are reading your stuff and saying things about it. Plus, SSRN, I believe they originally started out as a pre-press. You post things there before you get them published. So maybe this could be the same sort of thing. Here's an idea for a paper I've got. You know, tell me what you think of it, and then the whole conversation can happen. All right, one more piece about this. Nobody's going to come to this website, yet another website to drop comments. I consider my comments on blogs precious. I have something interesting to say, but they're sort of a throwaway, right? A blog, they go away, you know. Maybe the person says, thanks, great comment. You know, pat me on the back. Well, I think what law professors want, and especially if they're commenting on weighty issues like scholarship, they want to preserve those things. And the way and the place they want to preserve them is maybe back on their blog. So we thought that we would have a button there that basically says, and you can barely see this at the bottom, not just comment here, but I'm going to press this button. It's going to take a picture of this screen of the paper, or maybe a portion of it, and my comment, and it's going to stick it right into my blog using weblog API, or something similar like that. All right? So this becomes a blog post generating system. And if you're a blogger, how many bloggers? How many bloggers? Every so often, right? You know, you're like, oh, I'm doing good. I'm getting a couple a week up. You know, I can't think of anything to write about this week. Right? Okay, I can't think of writing about this month. I have nothing interesting to say. You know, this is a way to say, I have something interesting to say about this guy's scholarship, and it's on my blog, and it's in this system. So it becomes a sticky way to bring people into the system where you can aggregate comments, sort of like a co-comment-like system, but it's also a way to push commentary about scholarship out into places where people already exist, blogs. All right. Last system, I'm not going to talk about that one unless you ask about me in the questions. So let me wrap this up. E-Langdell. I got to talk about E-Langdell, right? I'm here at Harvard. E-Langdell is about the idea that law professors produce course materials, whether they be supplemental or they write their own casebooks, or even they use their own casebooks and produce a syllabus, and that there's another communication channel on that. Why I structured my course this way, why I chose this casebook, this case, how I sequence things. And wouldn't that be cool if they would all pool that into one place so that you can create any number of collective course packs or casebooks, all right? And we can get out of the, it takes 4 years to update a casebook. We can get out of the, it costs $120 for a casebook. I mean, the casebooks are 50% public domain material anyhow. All right, and so that's what E-Langdell is. It's a tool that would sit on top of a legal education commons of edited cases, syllabus, podcasts, multiple choice questions, analysis, commentary, right? Also hopefully structured in a way that you could Lego block lies, reassemble it into something, squirt it off the lulu.com. Do you know what Lulu is? It's a print-on-demand publisher, $18, 500 pages. Right? That's with no profit margin built in. And so for those transition times when we still need paper because we're not comfortable enough with electronic, you can still sell your book or sell the course materials to the student, but at 80% cheaper. But also you could take that thing and pour it back into the commons. So if somebody writes a great chapter on rule against perpetuities, then everybody else benefits. A new case comes down, and the IP law, the cyber law folks are great at this. New case comes down, somebody raises their hand and says, I'll edit it down because I know you're going to want to teach it tomorrow in class. And they'll cut it into what little pieces there are. Well, that should all be shared, and that's what the whole idea of E-Langdell is, to turn this into a large digital course material production system. All right? There are already existing communities of faculty doing similar things like this, sharing their syllabi, sharing problem sets. Counseling centrals for interviewing and counseling students. The Clinical Legal Education Association, ALS sections do this all the time. And so to bring this talk full circle, and I've gone on way longer than I expected to, the thing that faculty need to have in this is attribution, right? Because we're really talking about ego space. They also need quality signals, you know? Is it somebody from Yale that did that, or is it somebody from some other school that did that? Because that gives me some sort of signal. Might be a positive or negative signal. I'm not saying, right? And so we're dealing with both prestige and economics and sort of quality signals at the same time. You know, should I use this stuff and can I get prestige by contributing to the comments, right? A lot like Slashdot moderates comments. A lot like eBay says this guy's a good seller, hardly any negatives. Amazon says this is a good book, and then Amazon even does meta moderation, right? This is a good comment about this book, and SSRN, which counts downloads and things like that. All right, so back to everything. Something I want should look more like that. Something I want and I can find and serves a need I already have. All right, I want to build course materials, and I don't want to do from scratch. I want to record my classes or listen to other faculty who have recorded similar classes, so that my students have supplemental material if they don't understand me, and is of good quality. And I don't want to just send them to any old mope out on the internet. I want to know who that person is. All right. So that's the challenge, I think, of subclassing the commons, cutting it into pieces, and building tools that make it more available and accessible to people. And I see that as Callie's very interesting goal. is to be working in that space over the next decade or so. And I thought I'd just leave that up in case people had questions as a sort of a visual cue for anything else. Questions? You know, that was a lot of material. Sure.
Something that I'd be interested in really is, you know, something that was really accessible to someone who's not in law school, so they could, you know, sort of take a course or just learn about a particular field of interest. And are you doing anything in that area to sort of break down the barrier of this information for someone who's not already, you know, an expert?
LearnTheLaw.org. It's a website by Cali where you can purchase, you can get some free stuff, but you can purchase access to Cali lessons for like, you know, $10 for a month or $50 for a year, and you get access to all 200 of those lessons. I would imagine, I'm really big on the idea of legal literacy. I think that those A to J author things, let me show you something really quick about that. Preview.
Welcome to the Ventura County Court.
Stop. Stop. All right. You'll notice that it's got a learn more button. And in situations where the author wanted to explain some legal topic, like here, like, well, what is a fee waiver? You can press learn more and there's a little text description. Well, I can imagine that going out to a video of somebody saying, let me explain this to you, a screencast, you know, some sort of multimedia thing, even like, you know, hey, I want to learn more, right? This is not necessarily aimed at people who want to represent themselves in, you know, massive litigation situations. This is aimed at pro se's who are in trouble, who want to solve their problems. But I think we all need to have, we're all being forced to have more legal literacy, certainly intellectual property literacy, you know, and I think there's a market for that. I don't know that there's a money market for that, but there's an interest for that. And that's what Learn the Law is about, and that's also how we will try to feed that through this Access to Justice project as well. Well, fortunately, the lessons have driven us to the point of you know, every law school is a member, maybe one or two are not, right? They pay us $5,000 per year, right? 200 schools, $5,000. $1 million a year is what our income is right now. Maybe we pull another $100,000 or so in various grants, you know, and other sort of things like that. And that's enough to keep us going to do everything that I've just talked about.
Nobody else gets it.
No, for that they get everything we produce, and as much as possible I'm trying to give everything else away. Right? So I can't give the lessons away. We've done a lot of talking about giving the lessons away, making them completely wide open. And I've always run into the problem that a good number of law schools perceive us as just our lessons and would drop us in an instant. And so our sustainability would disappear. All right? But every new project I'm doing, Scholarship Pulse, the podcasts, those are actually available not just to Cali members, but to anybody on the wider web.
The range of things you're doing is, you've been there for a long time. You started early and precursive to so much of what I see other people doing, I see in Cali. MIT's OpenCourseWare is a tremendous initiative right down the street, which has focused on making open syllabi of courses. They have just started with videoing classes. They have 21 offerings that are video, and they're starting on that end, perhaps. And they've really raised the question for us as to whether there isn't a tremendous opportunity for Harvard Law School to step up into the video space, basically the YouTube space, with law education, recognizing a mission for the law school as offering legal education to the world, not just to our own students. And not necessarily in a credit, we're not talking University of Phoenix.
No, of course not.
We're talking about what you're talking about, that is, running something that's very serviceable for your law student constituency, our law student constituency, that also is capable of educating a much wider field of people and doing all a wonderful, wonderful parallel between just what MIT says its open courseware has done for it in terms of improving courses, improving student relationship to courses, improving faculty exposure. Wonderful parallel all the way through. And so I've been wondering, what's the connection between the for-profit business producers, the people who would like help us do serious production of what we're doing on many fronts, including audio versions of cases and video versions and animated versions of problems and all the myriad ways you can imagine of expressing yourself as an educational institution in a way that's potentially open to commons, but yet also completely servicing our own constituency in a way that's satisfactory. Somehow there's a relationship between the nonprofit and the profit entity. So just for example, suppose a company came to you and said, we're very interested in doing what you do. We would like to make versions of stuff that would be totally user-friendly to law students who like to exercise and want to soak up their knowledge through an iPod. And we'd like to partner with you. You putting out the wide open stuff, us adding on some value. Is that the kind of deal you'd imagine, or?
No.
No.
Because and the reason is I don't think there's not enough money in it for them to do it. But let me speak to the where is there some money here? Because it's not necessarily profit we need, but we do need some money for sustainability of a pure commons or an open source sort of project. And here's the answer, I think. The casebook market is about a $90 million market. All right? So law students spend about $90 million a year buying casebooks. I don't know whether or not that includes supplements, Gilberts and things like that. I have a feeling, and this is a stretch, but bear with me. So imagine you could be Clayton Christensen on that market and come in with essentially a 30 or 40 casebooks in 5 years that are not casebooks, but are casebooks. They're like Uber casebooks. And faculty could adopt portions of them and mix and match them. In other words, Cali or we would pay faculty to write casebooks, probably pay them more than they would get from a commercial vendor to write a casebook, except they wouldn't get royalties. They would get all this money up front, and then they would give it to us, and we would give it away for free. So after we've got 30 or 40 casebooks covering every subject area, the pressure is going to be on faculty from their students to say, well, why are you using this $110 4-year-out-of-date casebook when you could go use this $18 for the book or free for the PDF? All right? Now, maybe not free. Maybe we say to people who want to use this, look, it's free if you're just coming along to browse. But if you're going to use this in your class, it's charge your students. We're going to charge your students $20. Right? It's 80% cheaper than what it is. That $20, though, will give us an ongoing revenue stream that will feed the payment of future faculty to write more casebooks that we will give away for free. Right? So a $90 million market becomes a $20 million market, potentially. $20 million is enough to do this sort of commons thing. And then once it gets to a critical mass, I think it might run by itself, where no for-profit venture can add value, certainly not in any sort of information-rich way, because manipulation of information is becoming cheap.
On cyber law.
Sorry. On what?
What cyber law? What would stand between you and doing the
I'm
first one?
I'm doing exactly what I just said. That's what Elangdell is. So that's how I anticipate. We won't give these books away for free. We'll charge $20 for them. And the students will go, $20. Yay! They won't go, well, you should charge nothing. No, they're going to say, compared to 110. Faculty say, oh, it's free or it's cheap, it must be crap, right? So we're going to have to do the Clayton Christensen innovator dilemma. We'll come in at the people who don't like any of the books that are out there, one. Two, we'll come in at the people who there are no good casebooks in the area. Three, we'll come into people who do heavy supplementation. I'll just create a supplement, you know, and then it'll creep up the market into, well, I can just teach my whole class this way. I've already talked to a half a dozen faculty who have said exactly that to me. I've written my own casebook. It's my website. As soon as you're ready, you know, show me where to FTP it.
Is this something that H2O would be adapted to?
Oh, absolutely. I saw your playlist and I said, oh, that's exactly what we're...
You have a playlist and the ability to save moves.
Exactly. Because playlists are plucking out pieces, right? But hopefully, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of really hard problems that we're trying to solve with this. One of them is metadata, right? If people just dump stuff in there without any good metadata, we don't know what it is, you know? And we got to know that this is property, adverse possession, you know, one of these things, not just property, right? The second one is...
you have to do that tagging yourself, that you don't expect user input to
set. No, we got to make the users do it, right? That's got to be a requirement. You know, maybe we can hire rafts of cheap graduate students, Rob Curley calls internology, right? Interns, you know, who will walk through some of this stuff and do that for us. But I think right up front, we got to be educating people to do their own meta tagging and just make it easy, right? Pull down lists, you know, and of course, on top of that taxonomy, that's a rigid thing. We would also allow a delicious like thing, you know, for other searches. I mean, that's a no-brainer.
Other areas might suggest you're looking for surge, and surge is a reciprocal function of the difficulty of putting stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
Tagging is definitely a difficulty of putting it. YouTube lives on the fact that you don't really have to tag it.
Right. I know.
You don't
have a feeling we're going to pay. Right? I have a feeling we're... Right.
Somebody else, it's an extraordinarily essential function to making any kind of library structure work, that eventually well-tagged material, that is what accessibility is dependent upon. But it doesn't necessarily mean that function's got to be performed by the faculty member who's doing the first input that you absolutely need to get started.
Right. Well, they know, you know, they know more about their own material than anybody.
No, their students actually know more about how to tag it than the faculty does.
Good point. So, you know, if we know that the students are taking the course and using the materials, and we do because they've logged in and downloaded them, maybe we can ping them to come back and say, please help us tag this. If we're paying people to write this stuff, you know, here's $10,000, write a casebook for us, which is a lot of money to be paid for writing a casebook, by the way. You know, we can force some meta tagging on them, or at least, you know, surround them with some of that. Sure, all sorts of social things for that.
There's a really interesting experiment starting at it's called Freebase. Comes from MetaWeb.
Freebase?
Yeah, it's sort of a
unfortunate choice of names.
I think not accidental. Okay. It's play on Google Base.
Okay. I didn't know where the joke was coming. Yeah.
It's not much of a joke. Anyway, so it's been getting a fair bit of attention, even though it's in closed beta, so not a lot of people have seen it, and I haven't. But it sounds like a really interesting mix of starting with an initial taxonomy. This Freebase covers everything in the world, from businesses to CDs. So this is one of the things that it could cover, or this approach could cover. So start with an initial stab at a taxonomy. What are the fields that we need, really? You only need one person to tag each of the things. You don't have to
One tag, right.
Yes, and so just one person has to do it, and if she gets it wrong, somebody will fix it. So it has...
Mechanical Turk.
Exactly. And the second part of it is a wiki for altering the metadata schema.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to get it exactly... You won't get it exactly right. Somebody's going to say, oh, we also need this, and they'll put it in, and there'll be some wiki argument back and forth. And so they're hoping that for most of the web, they're going to generate lots and lots of metadata through this Mechanical Turk approach, as well as a wiki approach to taxonomy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a really exciting prospect. It may well work, and this could be a hybrid of the two that will work for...
Mm-hmm. I think the Elingdale project will, once it gets if we get a critical mass in an area, the faculty will love it. because basically they'll say, yeah, a new case came out in labor law. You know, now they got to wait the 2 years for the new book to come out. They got to use a new book. Oh, new book. No, somebody will, you know, on the discussion list, because they don't do blogs, on the discussion list, somebody will say, who's going to write this up and stick it into our comments, the labor law teacher's comments? And somebody will say, I'll do it, or three people will do it so that there's choice. And then everybody else will just benefit from it.
Can I ask a question of Charlie, actually? I mean, Charlie, you're not just the professor, but you're one of the incumbents who has a book that's published in a traditional manner. And I'm just curious what your view on this is on both fronts as a professor teaching, but also as an author of an existing casebook.
Well, I was shocked, not this year, because I didn't assign my book this year, but last year, when a student told me that they had paid $106 for my book, and I realized that of the sum, 900 pages in the book, I'd asked them to read somewhere under 200.
Ooh.
And I said, this is unconscionable, I can't assign this book. I would be totally thrilled to participate. The evidence particularly is suited to an approach where you state problems so that the long exegesis treatise material that people spend time with is just not a significant part of it. And it would be totally delightful to have a modular environment of evidence problems presented in text, audio, visual, any other way that you could use it to piece together to stimulate a class.
Mm-hmm.
My only problems at this point is my publisher owns the copyright on the book.
That's right.
So what is my ability to take stuff out of there and put it out in the commons?
Almost, yeah, little or none. And that's a problem, too, because we're basically creating a new press, right? And we're going against 100 years of established presses. But I think it's, like I said, a Clayton Christensen innovative dilemma. We're going to work from, we'll pick off the low-hanging fruit problems, and we'll work our way up over the years. There's another thing that gives us an advantage here. And it's demography. Over the next 10 years, a whole bunch of law professors are going to retire because they're in their 60s or 70s. And a whole bunch of authors of casebooks are going to retire. All right? And not all of them have signed away all their copyrights. And it might be that the word legacy will attract them to donate their materials into this commons. You know, or maybe they don't even have a casebook. You know, think of any law professor retiring saying, well, I've got all this teaching materials. I'd hate to let it just all go away. You know, I don't know. Can this become a digital presidential library archive sort of thing? You know, and those people are the most prestigious people out there. They've been teaching the longest. They've been around the longest. They're well known. What a wonderful way to preserve their value and benefit all you kids who are coming up.
So as the author to grab them back. I wonder if that any version of that would apply here.
I think the potential problem with that is that I think they copyright each separate edition. So
yeah,
just re-ups
each one, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Right. Your cell phone contract.
Well, at some point there would
at some point in the older professor zone.
Sure, probably.
And this is a big problem. It took forever to find uncopyrighted cases. That I needed a collection of cases that, you know, I can't get them from Lexis or West. There's a contract that says you can't download them, right? Faculty ignore it when they're writing their own books, and that's a polite fiction. But if an organization that was trying to aggregate these efforts were to do it, you know, lawsuit city. So I've had to go out and find places where I can buy the public domain versions of electronic versions of cases that I can make available to faculty so they can re-edit them down. And hopefully not the same way as they are edited down in the casebooks, because that's copyrightable as well, right? Selection and sequence is a problem. So, you know, we have to be careful and aware of the environment we're in. But I think there's plenty of room to play, is all I'm saying. I did want to mention about, you know, you mentioned MIT. There's Carnegie Mellon's Open Courseware Initiative. And there's Rice Connections. I think you may have all heard of that. All similar ideas to this. Except they have a much harder job because they're dealing with the university which has all sorts of departments. And I'm dealing with only the law schools. And law schools are insular and circumscribed, sufficiently circumscribed, as to be, what's the word, that we could do this. You know, we could even lead the rest of the world, say, you know, there's literally no other organization I know of that's like Cali. That's, you know, just instructional design, you know, research and development, and for just an area. There's no computer-assisted business instruction, computer-assisted political science instruction, or things like that. And so I think we can leverage the uniqueness of law schools and their status within universities towards that end.
Thank you very much.
I can say, I think you're absolutely right. We're doing our Internet Society conference here. That can then help make those decisions. And its focus is really on universities. Of all of the points that I think that is put across in the conference, it's the idea that Harvard isn't the client. Harvard is a leader of the university, and it's the university that is in some sense the client. And we're thinking about big fields in space. And to bring that down to the law school, which is our school, it's like the law school world is in some sense our client. And you're absolutely right. Cali is unique organization in that the infrastructure already in place of the kind of collective thought and arrangement for the production of common good. It's a legal structure. It's already got facial hair on it, you know, it's been around.
Yeah.
And it just seems like the most wonderful base to build out of if we could figure out how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you see ways for the Berkman Center to just really be helpful in your direction, you should be, you know, telling us, here's a proposed action plan. See what you can come up with.
Join us at 2 o'clock, Charlie, and we'll talk about it.
Huh?
Join us at 2 o'clock and we'll talk about it.
I was going to say, we'll be in touch.
Yeah. Well, with that endorsement, we'll end the public talk, and if people want to ask questions directly of John, we'll be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.